Platinum Perry is innocent, baby. Bend the knee. And with that, welcome to Early Stoppage, a show where the news of the day is usually given just enough time, but sometimes not enough. If this is your first time stopping by, we thank you and get ready for something you won't find anywhere else. I'm John Franklin. I am joined, as always, by the godfather of Fight Night Picks, Craig Allen. Craig, we are deep in this Fight Island game. I did not go with a Hawaiian shirt this week, but we're three fights in. How you feeling?
Feeling pretty good. I'm really excited for this weekend's card. And Matt kind of pulled me aside before we started making our predictions for the last video. And he said, you got to stop saying how excited you are for these fights. But like, I jazzed myself up. You have 15 fights on a card, the most in UFC history. And yeah, maybe some of them aren't the best, but like, I get myself jacked up for this. It's like Christmas every weekend for me. And sometimes on Wednesday.
All right, Craig gets himself jacked. I like it. All right, Craig, on this episode of Early Stoppage, we talked the stripping of John Jones, UFC Super 7, and Mauricio Shogun, who was fighting Future. But we begin with the Eagle, Khabib Nurmagomedov, Craig. It is unsure when the Eagle will land. This week I heard both Khabib say, go and fight Conor, to Justin Gaethje, and I'll see you when I see you. And that he is willing to fight at the end of the year. Dana has said that he will give Khabib all the time he needs. So, Craig, attack this in whatever way you want. But I guess my question is both, what do you think he is going to do, and what do you think he should do?
I think – time out. What do I think who's going to do? What do I think Khabib's going to do?
Khabib's the only person that matters at 55.
He's going to sit out a while and see what happens between McGregor and Gaethje, because that sets everything up quite well. I think the fight between Khabib and Gaethje is the fight that I want. I think it's a fight that we need at lightweight. It's the most competitive fight that you're going to get. It's the most compelling fight as well, because you can play off the fact that Tony Ferguson was always supposed to get that fight against Khabib. COVID popped in steps Justin Gaethje, steals all the thunder, and then all of a sudden, well, what do you do? I mean, you have to have a fight between Khabib and Gaethje. Yeah, Conor McGregor beat Donald Cerrone at the start of the year, but it was up a weight class. I don't care where Conor McGregor's ranked in the UFC's rankings. We've talked about it at length. It seems like every show we talk about how bad the UFC's rankings are and how much they don't matter. And maybe it's just me and it's not you, but I hate the rankings and they don't mean anything and they don't matter. So in this context, I think Khabib's playing it smart. And also, I mean, this is a guy that's still, you have to consider the passing of his father not that long ago, who was so influential on not just his life, but on the life of his training partners in an entire region in Russia, in Dagestan. So it's unfortunate what happened there. I think Khabib still needs some time away, and I think it sets up a good fight and a sellable fight between Gaethje and Conor. I think styles make fights. That's one of them. And the winner of that fight definitely deserves a shot. And I think Conor McGregor, and I know, you know, somebody might say, oh, you sound like a casual. I think there's a chance that he beats Gaethje. It's slight, but I think he has a chance.
Well, you know, there's a chance that Gaethje could be to Khabib what Khabib is to Conor. He could be the, you know, the antidote to whatever Khabib has. So, you know, I think that it's different with Khabib's father dying than other people whose parents die, because Khabib's father was so connected to his fighting career. So when Khabib returns to get into condition and to get into, you know, put a game plan together and get ready for a fight, he has a huge void in doing that. I'm with you. I think that for him, if he knows he's got to fight these two guys eventually anyway, maybe he just lets them eliminate each other. Although, if you're up on your social media, Conor McGregor doesn't exactly look like he's training. You know, he's imbibing in any number of different recreational drugs, allegedly. So I don't know. I think that Khabib knows how serious Justin Gaethje is, and he doesn't want to just haphazardly go into a fight with him.
All right, John. Well, let's move into Conor McGregor's division. And we're talking welterweights. Jorge Masvidal said after his fight with Kamaru Usman that he has the formula to beat him. And now he's come out and says he prefers a rematch with Usman rather than a fight with the aforementioned Mystic Mac. Is fighting Kamaru Usman what's in Masvidal's best interest?
I'm so glad you asked this question, because I have a few things that I would like to talk about as it pertains to this. Number one, if you like Teddy Atlas, like I like Teddy Atlas, Teddy Atlas has a little bit of a relationship with Jorge Masvidal. Teddy Atlas said on his show recently to Jorge Masvidal that this fight was the fight where you take care of your family, and the next fight may be what fulfills your destiny to be a champion. The only thing that the gods, the combat gods, are waiting to see is how you react to losing the first fight. Your family's taken care of. Everything's good. The gods ask, what does he do next? So they're interested to see what Jorge Masvidal does next. Now, our fans are going to love this analogy. It's one of the best ones I'm ever going to give. So now that I've set it up that way, it has to deliver. Belts are like beautiful women, Craig. Everybody wants one, but they're a lot tougher to have than they are to get. And I think that when you have a beautiful woman, it's just like having a championship belt. Everybody wants it. You're constantly a target. Everybody's looking to come after you. So I do think that Jorge Masvidal wants to be champion. But this is not the Olympics where they just hand you the medal and you don't have to defend it. Once you have it, I mean, Anderson Silva, when he lost to Chris Weidman, looked like the happiest guy in the world. He was so glad to be rid of that belt. George St. Pierre, same thing. These long-reigning champions. So Jorge Masvidal certainly wouldn't be that were he to beat Kamaru Usman. But I just think that I think he should to answer the question finally, I think he should fight Usman because he's the guy that he's got in the front of his mind. He knows the game plan. There's a lot of money that comes with Conor. It's probably a more winnable fight, but Usman's the fight for me.
I don't really think it is. I mean, we already saw what happened. He got his ass beat for five rounds or four rounds, I guess. But I think it's either Conor McGregor or Nate Diaz. The Nate Diaz rematch is tempting. I mean, he beat Nate Diaz quite handily, but the way that the fight ended, it left it open to having a pretty good rematch. That's the money fight. That's the play. And in terms of the sporting aspect of it, what's the difference of a full 8-week camp or 6 weeks to get ready for Kamaru Usman versus, you know, hopping in there in a week? Because if you look at it, Usman was getting ready for such a Swiss Army knife of Gilbert Burns. And then insert Jorge Masvidal. What's Masvidal good at? He's a great striker. Don't get me wrong. I don't want to discount what this guy's done over his body of work. But if you really want to break it down and boil it down to one thing, Jorge Masvidal is a pretty wonky striker. He has a lot of power. And he's quick. And he can do a lot of different things well on the feet. But apart from that, I don't think he poses much of a threat to Kamaru Usman in the long run. We know it now. Jorge Masvidal is on the wrong side of 34. Or I know he's 35. So I would, you know, split the difference if you want to. I don't know where his birthday falls. But still, I just don't see it for Jorge Masvidal. I don't think he has it in the tank to beat Kamaru Usman. So set out on more of those money fights.
Yeah, I think it gets interesting because that's a goal of his, and that seems like some sort of destination for him. But I'm with you. I've been calling for Masvidal to fight McGregor from the beginning. I think the fight makes more sense. I think that he should just give the fight to Gilbert Burns and move on. All right, Craig, speaking of championship fights, the gauntlet has been thrown down by Dominic Reyes to John Jones. Reyes, and I'm paraphrasing here, said, defend or vacate. Craig, does Reyes have the juice to make such an ultimatum to one of, if not the greatest fighter of all time? And what should John Jones do and what should the UFC do?
That's like, and I listened to a couple of different things, but that, you know, that's like listening to a band and, you know, let's say you're at a Metallica concert and somebody sits there and they're yelling out, sing Carly Rae Jepsen. They're not going to do it. They don't care. Dominic Reyes is that fan that's yelling at Metallica to play Carly Rae Jepsen. It's not going to happen. Do you think John Jones cares what Dominic Reyes says? To an extent, you know what? He probably does. Seems like the guy's got a bit of an ego. But realistically, what does it matter? I mean, you know, if Jan Blachowicz went on Polish national television and said, you know, the exact same thing, you think it would get to John Jones and he'd care? No. But where it's Dominic Reyes, maybe. And I, you know, I get it. That's why we're talking about it. It is a good subject. The thing that really concerns me is that Dominic Reyes lost that fight by unanimous decision. I understand it's close. The guy that has the bigger chip on his shoulder, or should have, or chips on his knees, is Thiago Santos, because one of those judges scored that fight for Santos when he fought John Jones. So as long as his knees are good, and I know we're going to talk about Thiago Santos later on in the show, I think he has the biggest leg up on all of these other guys, the Blachowiczes, the Reyeses, and whoever else you want to throw at the top of that conversation. I know Jiří Procházka is on the tip of everybody's tongue, so let's throw him in there too. I think that Santos has the biggest advantage going into this. Maybe Glover Teixeira is a bit of a dark horse, an old dark horse. But realistically, to get to the question, I mean, what should John Jones and the UFC do? Well, the conversation's always, and we've talked about it, does John Jones move up to heavyweight? I think we're going to get a little bit more clarity on that in the next couple of weeks after DC Stipe 3. We'll have a better idea, because I would think that both of those guys, no, whoever wins is probably going to do the Michael Bisping after he beat Luke Rockhold. Yeah, I'll fight. Yeah, sure. And then maybe set up like a Dan Henderson fight. And then, yeah, I'll fight and take a full year just to fight George St. Pierre. I think it's going to be one of those circumstances. So it's going to hold up both divisions. But realistically, to finally give my answer, I think John Jones is probably just waiting it out, letting these guys fight each other, seeing where Santos slots in. And I don't think Dominic Reyes running his mouth really changes anything.
I agree and I disagree. I think that Dominic Reyes, if I was him, I would start a propaganda campaign to show how close that fight was. To this extent, if I was Dominic Reyes, I'd call up Luke Thomas and say, hey, let's do a dissected, me and John Jones, and I'll be in studio. How about that?
So he was just on a show.
Right, yeah. So if I'm him, I start the propaganda campaign. If I'm John Jones, I tell everybody with a microphone, I already beat this guy. And this division has other fighters, and they've earned shots, and I should be fighting them, or I should be moving on to heavyweight. Like, I'm not going to fight someone I already beat. If I'm the UFC, I do everything I can to get these two guys back in the cage, because the UFC severely dropped the ball with Alexander Gustafsson. And, you know, Gustafsson and Jones had a very close fight. Now, in fairness to what I'm sure you're about to say, John Jones played a role in that as well. Obviously, he had some time off in between when he fought Gustafsson the first time and the second time, so they couldn't immediately rebook the matchup, and I get that. But I think that when you have this close of a fight, you have to make sure, you know, anything could happen with Dominic Reyes. And now the old saying goes, if Dominic Reyes books another fight and loses, well, he didn't deserve the title shot in the first place. But at the same time, you have it. It's much like my Cody Garbrandt theory. You have a guy who's coming off an impressive performance. You book him in the biggest fight you can as quick as you can.
Yeah, my thoughts here, I mean, the Gustafsson reference, I got to say, there's prop bets out there right now. The line on me versus Fabrizio Verdum is set at minus 8,000 Verdum, and it's a plus 2,000 to bet on me. That was set by a viewer because I said that Fabrizio Verdum looks like a bag of milk, and Alexander Gustafsson's going to beat his ass. There's no way Verdum wins that fight. So, just like Michael Bisping, talk shit, get banged. And I'm kind of in that position right now. So the props are out there. I'd like to see what would happen. I think Verdum takes me out in 5 seconds, quicker than he took out Wal Harris. That's how quick, and at least half the time. But Gustafsson's getting his due fighting a former champ, and they can build off of that. But overall, yeah, Dominic Reyes can make for a strong case. I just disagree, and I don't think that that's the fight to make. But I'll tell you one thing, John, switching gears. I don't know if Hamzat Chimaev is a fan of Chicago Cubs Hall of Famer Ernie Banks. Listen, they're finally going to have night games on Fridays. Get excited, baseball fans. But he's sure acting like it. Ernie Banks is famous for saying, let's play two. And Chimaev, fresh off his domination of John Phillips, the Welsh wrecking machine, or the White Mike Tyson, still great nicknames. He's looking to keep the train going this weekend against Northern Ireland's Rhys McKee. It's definitely an interesting move. And again, at welterweight this time. But the question is this a smart fight for Chimaev and the promotion coming back this soon?
It's a gimmick. Why not? The kid's fresh. I mean, really, what does he have to lose except the fight? I mean, I think that if you could market this as the kid, you know, they like to call guys BMFs and talk about how Cerrone takes fights on short notice. I think this is another way to get the kid out there. He isn't someone who has like this like crazy personality. So you can't like sit him in the stands like you did with Amanda Ribas. So, I think, send him back out there. Hopefully he does to McKee what he did to Phillips, and then the train keeps moving.
Rhys McKee is a legit prospect. I talked about it in the prediction video where I think that Rhys McKee has a really high ceiling. You're probably ruining his own personal brand and his start by putting him in on such short notice against a guy that is so dominant. But the problem is you got to pump the brakes with Hamzat Chimaev, because let's say he beats Rhys McKee. What's next? Somebody threw it out there in the YouTube comments section, said Warley Alves. I think that's an awesome matchup because Alves is a really big welterweight. He's got to win over Colby Covington. You get Chimaev beating him. There's a name. Alves 3-4 in the UFC, so it's not that great. But what do you do? Because if Hamzat Chimaev wins this weekend, he's 8-0. Like, do you really want him fighting ranked competition in the UFC? He looks like a world beater, but John Phillips is not a good middleweight. Like, he was, what, 1-4 in the UFC? and his one win was over a guy who was making his debut and he knocked him out in 10 seconds. Like, it's not a good litmus test to see what you have. I think Khamzat Chimaev has all the talent in the world. I think he's just getting started, kind of like Rodolfo Vieira at 185. I think Rodolfo Vieira, not enough people know about him. Hopefully he gets a chance to fight more this year. I think he's uber talented. He's like 36 years old, so that plays a bit of a factor, but he doesn't have a lot of miles on him. Same thing with Chimaev. Overall, it's not going to hurt his career. And to this end, Tanner Boser's fighting this weekend on short notice against Rafael Pessoa. And Tanner Boser fought like just a couple days short of a month ago and knocked out Felipe Lins. And somebody said, is it too quick for Tanner Boser? He got hit by six strikes from Felipe Lins. That's like flipping a burger in a barbecue and you got kids punching you behind you at a party. You don't have to worry about it. So for Tanner Boser, it's not too quick. For Chimaev, it's not too quick. And life moves on.
I agree. And we move on as well. All right, Craig, Dana White said this week that if Vegas shuts down, they might just live out there on Fight Island. Craig, I'm an American. And as such, I can tell you that Vegas is back, kind of. I know some people there and have seen some social media posts of people kind of just doing what they want in Sin City. I saw something on social media where Fremont Street was packed. So if Vegas closes down and Dana continues business as usual out of Fight Island, do we all owe him a huge apology for building Noah's Ark before the rain?
You guys are so screwed down there. Man, things are bad in the States. I hate to hammer it home. Listen, I wore this for effect tonight. So I'm wearing a Pittsburgh Pirates jersey. Why? Because I was going to get excited for my Toronto Pirates or my Pittsburgh Blue Jays. But guess what, John? Canada said no to the Blue Jays, and today Pittsburgh said no to the Blue Jays. So right now the Blue Jays are traveling sideshow and they don't have a home. Why do I say that? Because that's just like the UFC. And the UFC, if they can't find a home in Vegas, why not stay in Abu Dhabi? Why not fly people out there? I mean, the protocols seem to be good. Nobody's been getting COVID there that I've seen. I mean, we've seen people in traveling to Abu Dhabi get it, but we haven't seen anybody there get sick. So the UFC seems to be doing a pretty good job. I think they're in tight with the government that's there. They're getting a pile of money. And so what? You know what? So what if I have to see seven or eight ads for hashtag in Abu Dhabi or somebody out on a beach in Abu Dhabi? I'm not going there. I don't care. So yeah, just keep pumping me with that propaganda and host the fights there. What do I care? Fights are on TV. I'm excited for it. What do I care?
Yeah, I think that the logistics of having all the fights there, that's Dana's problem. If he wants to fly American fighters there and he wants to deal with all that, then that's up to him. Now, where I think it really gets real interesting is that he's supposed to have DC and Stipe fight in Vegas, and I don't believe the big cage has been at the apex yet. So I think that the DC-Stipe fight changes dramatically in a smaller cage. So that'll be very interesting to see. So I think they're going to end up on Fight Island, to be honest with you. But my point is that, listen, he did it. He said he was going to do it. He did it. He has it there. It might be more I guess since they own the Apex, it's not a big deal to go back and forth because when they go back, they're just going back to the Apex. But, you know, he put the thing together. If he wants to spend the money to fly fighters from America to Abu Dhabi, that's his business. And I think that he did what he said he was going to do. You got to give the guy props. I don't want to get too far into the weeds with it because the crux of this question is, did he come through on what he said he was? And people are very critical of Dana, especially in the MMA media. And I think this time he pulled it off. I mean, the testing's going well. The fights are going well. Everyone seems to be happy. So I think it's a success. So if he has to do things just there, then so be it.
And hopefully the fight sphere comes through at the end of this week for Bellator. But that's a topic for another day. And, John, if we move along, Joseph Benavidez, after his loss to Deiveson Figueiredo this past weekend, said that it's not how he wants to go out. He wants to go out with another fight. That was his quote. And then right after that, he said, if I lose, I'm going to fight until I win again. So the question is, what happens next? Does Dana White and everybody involved with the UFC, do they sit him down? Do they say, hey, here's a job like Forrest Griffin. Go work at the Performance Institute. Here's a broadcast gig. We're going to try and put you into some box and give you some role. Or do they let him ride it out like BJ Penn?
I think they're going to look out for him because of the Megan Olivi connection, because of all that. But I think that he wants to do what he wants to do. And you know, one of the cliches that I say the most is the fighters don't retire, the ring retires them. And honestly, it depends on what we think of Davison Figueiredo as to whether or not Joseph Benavidez should be done with his career. Because if you think that Davison Figueiredo is an all-timer, right? Well, then Joseph Benavidez is essentially Rich Franklin without a belt. Rich Franklin got annihilated by Anderson Silva twice and came back and had an okay career. Went up to 205, did some things. He's a Hall of Famer. I would say that had he never fought again after he lost to Anderson, you'd probably put him in the Hall of Fame, but you can make an argument that he shouldn't be there. So my point is that he continued to have a career that led him there. Now, I think as far as Benavidez goes, you know, I think that he should do what he wants to do. It's his career. It's his life. I don't think he's to the point where he's taking these huge, massive beatings. He's lost to one guy twice. And it was a mess. But depending on what we think of Figueiredo, I say you put him out there with a guy fifth or sixth ranked in the world and just see what happens. If he hangs with him, let him keep fighting. If he doesn't, time to take a walk.
Well, that's it. Like, he's kind of the Jim Kelly of MMA, which is somewhere that you don't want to be. And then if you look at the top, let's look at the top 10. So he loses to Figueiredo, who they still don't have as a champion on the rankings. He's second. Brandon Moreno, who's probably going to get a title shot. Pantoja just lost to Askarov. Alex Perez, he's beaten him. Formiga fought him. Askarov, but you don't want that fight to happen because he's definitely going to lose that fight. Kai Kara France, Rogerio Bontorino, Matt Schnell. Sort of those last three guys, what's the fight that he's probably going to take the least amount of damage? I'd say probably Matt Schnell. Bontorino and Kai Kara France are going to bring the fight to you. So it's tough. Like, it's really tough. You never envision the end of your career going out on a loss. I mean, you know, in the Rocky movies, he loses sometimes, but the majority of the time he wins, you feel good. And then you go to bed and maybe you bang one out in the car before you go to bed. But if you really look at this in part, what's happened? I mean, he's lost four title fights. The last two of them, he's lost emphatically by finish. In the last one, he became a meme on social media. So do you just go out there and try and silence the haters and the doubters? Because they're still going to be there. They're still going to post those pictures. And if you don't care about that, then so be it. And if you want to make it a legacy thing, I understand it, but there's no easy test ahead.
You know, I would say lastly that, you know, for him, he's also now put himself in a position where everybody that fights him is going to come to the fight with the knowledge that he thinks he wants to go out making a statement on this guy, right? And unless he's so, you know, leaps and bounds better than the guy he's fighting, no one's going to want to sign up for that. Meaning no one's going to just walk in there and be like, all right, I'm Joe B's retirement fight and everybody loves him. So I'll just, you know, nobody wants to be that. So, but listen, lastly, and I'm going to defer back to you because listen, I got trolled by a Davison Figueiredo Twitter account thinking that, you know, Davison was taking that Davidson was taking some liberties with Megan O'Leary on his Twitter. So since I got fooled by that account, I'll give you the final word.
All right. So I'm going to make a really bad comparison of Joseph Benavidez's career. And I'm talking about an all-timer who finished his career from the latter half of 2014 on. He went 1-6, fought Ian McCall, Chico Camus, Thomas Almeida, got finished in one of those fights, beat Francisco Rivera, lost to Yuri Alcantara by finish, lost to Faber by decision, and got knocked out by Marlon Vera in a fight that was his retirement fight going out on his terms. Do you remember the guy?
I don't. Tell me.
One Punch, Brad Pickett.
That's right.
And I mean, everybody thinks of Brad Pickett now as, you know, he had a great career, one of England's finest. He manages a great team or runs a great gym. But I mean, he went out with a terrible finish and he went 1-6 in his, 1-6 in his last seven. So really at the end of the day, I think everybody's going to remember Joseph Benavidez as one of those guys, the greatest to never win the belt, whatever, but he's an all-time fighter in my opinion.
All right. So normally at this part of the show, we do sparring sessions. We're going to flip it up a little bit. We're going to go ahead and do our rank them because the rank them involves Joseph Benavidez. Dan Hardy came out this week with a list of the greatest fighters never to win a title. I will give you Hardy's list. And then Craig and I will pick it apart. All right, number one on Dan Hardy's list is Dan Henderson, followed by Kenny Florian, John Fitch, Chael Sonnen, Alexander Gustafsson, Antonio Nogueira, Uriah Faber, Alistair Overeem, Donald Cerrone, and then Joseph Benavidez. Craig, I will let you start. What sort of problems do you have with this list, if any?
I do have a pretty major problem with two of them, and I included one of these guys on one of my lists. Only one of them, if I'm looking through it. Yeah, only one of them. Dan Henderson. Why is it that everybody thinks, oh, well, he never won a belt, and it doesn't matter? Was he not Pride champion? Does that not hold any weight? Because to me, it does. Vanderlei Silva wasn't a UFC champion. So yeah, if you're looking at it, Dan Henderson, like, to me, former champion, and it mattered. It really mattered that he was a champ in Pride. And then Uriah Faber, was he not a WEC champ? Weren't you fighting against the best guys in the lower weight classes?
Okay, so here's where I'll just push back on that. The only thing that I will say is that when Henderson was fighting in Pride, you could make an argument. Now, this is where it gets really interesting, because when he was in Pride, he was, I believe, a double champ in Pride, 85 and 205. And that was at a time when the 205-pound division, 185-pound division, there was a lot of great fighters in Pride. When Uriah Faber fought WEC, so my point is, maybe this is more similar, so that you could make a case that Dan Henderson had beaten the best 85 and 205-pounders in the world when he was champion in Pride. For sure, when Uriah Faber was a WEC champion, because the UFC didn't have that weight class, he was fighting the best 135-pounders in the world because the UFC didn't have the weight class. So I think that if you want to get technical and say, yeah, it's a UFC belt, you have to agree with what Hardy said here. But how would you change this list?
I mean, Uriah Faber, Bibiano Fernandez, Joe Pearce, and Dominic Cruz. Jens Pulver on that list. It upsets me. It really does. Anyway, how would I have this? If Dan Henderson's Pride wins don't matter and he is on the list, he's probably my number one. Out of all these guys, I think that has to be number one. I really do. I mean, kept getting there, never did it. And I mean, the worst one, and I harp on it a lot, he shouldn't have gotten the title shot against Michael Bisping. There was bad blood when they fought for the middleweight championship, but... like, he was in his mid-40s, so what did it really matter? And it was a competitive fight, but to me, Dan Henderson's a guy. He always reached the pinnacle, but never really did. You know what I mean?
Yeah, my big problem with this is Kenny Florian at number two. And maybe I'm just sort of – I think the fact that Kenny Florian is a well-liked analyst is part of the reason why there's been a little bit of revisionist history, revisionist MMA, if you will, with Florian's career. Yes, he won the Ultimate Fighter. Well, no, he didn't win the Ultimate Fighter. He came in second. So, but I just don't see it. I mean, he fought BJ, got destroyed. I just don't see it. But to have him at number two over Fitch and Sonnen and Gustafsson and Faber, I just don't get it.
If Kenny Florian's that high, then where's TJ Grant? I mean, give me Nova Scotia's TJ Grant. Or where's – there was a name and now it's escaping me. Where's that guy?
But Gray still, Maynard.
Gray Maynard, sure. Yeah, Gray Maynard. Awesome fights. Awesome fights against Edgar. Not here. I don't get it. I mean, the one other name to me, Nogueira? What? What are we doing? Why? And if it's Big Nog, this is the other thing that concerns me about these lists. Fighters that never win a title. Well, if it's Big Nog, he was an interim UFC heavyweight champ.
So. It's Little Nog. But yeah, I'm with you.
No, it's and if it's Little Nog, then I don't care. I really don't.
All right, quickly. You have to reform. You can only use these fighters. You have to reshuffle the order. Give it to me.
Well, you know, for me, that apparently Florian's 10, Little Nog's 9, so now I can work backwards. Overeem's got to be pretty high. Henderson's quite high. Sonnen would have to be high. Gustafsson is the thumbnail of a video that we did months ago about this exact same topic. Cerrone was in there. To me, Benavidez, again, 0-4, that's a tough one. So you want me to go 1 through 10, rip them through?
I'll even help you out. You can leave Gustafsson at, because this is how I'm going to do it. You can leave Gustafsson at 5.
Sure.
And tell me who's better and who's worse. That's an easier way to rank them.
Henderson 1. Cerrone too, but again, he wasn't interim when he fought Dos Anjos, was he?
No,
he won a number one contenders fight to get the Dos Anjos fight. Henderson won, Cerrone two, Sonnen three. You could flip flop those two. At four, I'd have Overeem, five, Gustafson, six, Faber. Yep. Then seven, Benavidez, then Fitch, then, Nogueira, then Florian.
Okay, I'm a little higher. My list is similar. I'm a little bit higher on Sonnen and Fitch than you are, and a little bit lower on Cerrone. So Henderson, Sonnen, Fitch, Overeem. So now I'm at five. Which we'll keep with Gustafson. I'm the one that started. I might as well finish it. Faber, Cerrone, Little Nog, Florian and Benavidez. Wouldn't be a bad fight, by the way, at 45. I don't know if Florian can be 35. Florian's probably too big for him. I'll go Florian, then Benavidez. All right, there you have it. I think for Kenny Florian to be that high, Dan Hardy must have been that high. Sorry, bud. All right, sparring sessions, let's move on. Greg, Daniel Cormier came out this week and said that he fumbled the second fight with Stipe Miocic and that he should have won. Greg, if we had a nickel for every fighter who said it was their fault, not their opponents, that they lost, we could buy Fight Island. But some of them have to be right. So my question to you, Craig, is DC right?
It's a good question. It really is. I mean, if you look at it, he fumbled the second fight and he should have won. He was en route to winning that fight. Just like, you know, I thought Colby Covington was winning his fight against Kamaru Usman until he got finished. So it's kind of the same logic. It's kind of the same logic of, you know, if you look at Max Holloway in the first fight that he had against Volkanovski, Volkanovski definitely won that fight. Unless you're Max Holloway or Rush Holloway or anybody in Hawaii, you probably thought that Alexander Volkanovski won that fight. Well, why did he win that fight? He put the pressure up, and vice versa. Max Holloway didn't change his game plan. Cormier did that, and it worked. So he had the same game plan, pressure, fought really well. In that third and fourth round, Stipe Miocic turned the tide and changed his own game plan, started landing those nice body shots, and that was kind of a path to the end, and that's how we saw him end up getting the win. He set it up well, and he changed his initial game plan. Holloway in that fight against Volkanovski didn't. In the second fight, Holloway came out guns a-blazing, and Volkanovski was forced to switch in the third, fourth, and fifth rounds. So for DC, you know, he's saying that he fumbled it, and he probably should have won it. I agree with it. He just didn't really change his game plan. Could have brought his hands lower, could have blocked the body, could have moved a different way, and he didn't. If you consider that a fumble, sure, I guess. Then he fumbled it and he should have won. Do we think he's going to win the third fight? I got to watch that fight. Probably not the Luke Thomas 49 times. I'll probably watch it three or four times to try and pick up on some of those smaller things. But for me, I think I'd say he's probably right. Because if you look at just even the striking totals for those four rounds, I'm quite sure, and I had them in front of me. I have them in front of me. Let's see, 71 of 83 to 9, 59 to 48, 69 to 40, 31 to 38 in the fourth round when Stipe won it. So, yeah, he was taking that fight pretty easily.
Yeah, I watched the fight today just because I remember what I thought at the time, but I just kind of wanted to get some more insight on it. For what I could see, the momentum was kind of going Stipe's way at the end of the second, into the third, but DC was still there. So when you look at the striking numbers and the stats, you see that DC's still ahead in the stats, but Stipe's closing the gap. I think that – I don't want to say that Daniel Cormier has some sort of jealousy or envy of Cain Velasquez, but sometimes I feel like that he wants to assert himself a certain type of fighter that he just isn't. He'll never be the kickboxer that Cain Velasquez was. Even though he's good in it with his hands and his feet at times, he looked great in the beginning of that fight. But I think his insistence on staying on his feet, I don't know if it was a fatigue thing or what it was, but he just would not close the distance, especially when he realized, because the beauty of the adjustment that Stipe made, he made two really serious adjustments. One, he stopped hand fighting with DC. So what DC was doing was he was hand fighting and then turning that into punches. And he was just quicker to that than Stipe was, right? That was his game plan. He was quicker to it. And the second thing was Stipe started going to the body, like you said. But the beauty of him going to the body was when he went to the body, he was dipping his shoulder. He would dip his left shoulder and go to the body. And that landed a bunch. But there were times when he dipped his left shoulder and went to the head. So if you're DC, it looks like, why isn't he just covering up these body shots? It's because he didn't know if he was going to go to the body or the head. So I think that made it very interesting. And, you know, Chael said something this week that I have said forever, so I'm going to quote it so I can kind of take a victory lap of my own, which is if you spend 8 to 10 weeks training, you train all the positive things about your game plan, but you also train the negative things in your game plan too. You train holes into your game plan. And if someone finds them early, you can't possibly close them in a short period of time. He could not close that body shot hole. What he could have done was taken him down. That way it wouldn't even be an issue because they're off the feet.
You know, my favorite DC fight, and this gets into a wormhole, so I'm only going to go just so far. My favorite DC fight, or one of my favorites, is UFC 220. And there's some reasons why. I was there, and I love live sports. That atmosphere is awesome. But remember how the fight ended? He had Volkan Oezdemir in a crucifix. He got the fight to the ground. I don't see why he doesn't do something like that, like he did in that fight.
I think that he's trying to prove a point, or was, in the same way John Jones was trying to prove a point. John Jones, when he fought DC, said, I'm going to out-wrestle you, and he did. So DC felt like, because of his success in the first round or maybe in the previous fight, just he felt like he could, you know, and the funny part about it was Stipe was nowhere near him on the ground. He took Stipe down the first and kept him down there for damn near the whole round. So there was no, other than the fact that he was being successful with the hand fighting and quit. I mean, he was landing. In fairness to Cormier, he was landing. But the question that I ask, I used to ask Keith, and now I ask Cameron, and we've talked about before, is when you're in the middle of a fight, you have to ask yourself, whose fight are we fighting? And even if you're doing well, if you're fighting the other guy's fight, it's just a matter of time before it goes the wrong way. All right, Craig, let's move on. Let's move on to this or that. This week's this or that deals with the Super 7. Someone posted online this week that the current crop of UFC champions have very few losses among them. And that raised the question, is this group better than the Super 7, which was the group of champions that held a press conference back in 2011? The Super 7 was, or is, depending on how you look at it, they're all still alive. Cain Velasquez, John Jones, Anderson Silva, George St. Pierre, Frankie Edgar, Jose Aldo, and Dominic Cruz. So, Craig, let's do this or that by matching the Super 7 up against the current champs. I will take the burden from you of having to do this or that. You can just say which one you would choose. All right, let's start at the heavyweight division. I have a little bit of background if you need it. If you don't, then forget it. But the heavyweight division would be Cain versus Stipe. So take your pick between Cain and Stipe.
If we're going prime for prime, I would say, and it's a tough one, I'd say Cain Velasquez. I really would. And for the reason that we were talking about earlier. I mean, Stipe, great boxing, really good wrestling, but not to the level that Cain had when he was on top.
So the context I'll give you is that when this interview took place, it was April of 2011. He had just destroyed Brock Lesnar, that is Cain, and was about to lose to Junior Dos Santos in November.
But he hadn't yet.
So I think that Cain, that defeated Brock Lesnar, would definitely have to be the better of the two fighters, although it would be an interesting fight. All right, up next, John Jones then versus John Jones now.
2011, was that like Ryan Bader time?
I think he fought Ryan Bader. I promised you the background to this, and I was not ready. So in 2011, John Jones, so if it was April of 2011 when this interview took place, he had just defeated Shogun.
Yeah, so I think John Jones then beats John Jones now, because I don't know how much evolution's happened in John Jones' game since then. He was a lot more creative. He was searching for the finish more. So I go Jones then.
And just for complete context, he was about to fight Rampage, was about to fight Machida, was about to fight Evans. So he was right there. I agree with you. I think the John Jones then took more risks. I think John Jones then was more athletic. I think he was more of an – there was not a technique that was not available to him. He was not as strong as the John Jones now, but didn't need to be.
And I want to say something. For us to say that those two guys, the then beats the now, totally shakes the narrative that current fighters would definitely beat older fighters.
I agree. All right, up next at 185 pounds, there's two fights, quote-unquote, fantasy fights, on this list that actually have happened. This is the first one. Anderson Silva versus Israel Adesanya. Anderson Silva of 2011 versus Israel Adesanya. So this is obviously Anderson's prime.
That's a tough one. Because, I mean, people want to go back and harp on Adesanya when he fought Marvin Vettori and he got taken down and it was a split decision win. I still think Prime Silva might beat him. More tools. But the context Israel Adesanya is such a good striker.
The context that I promised is he had just beaten Chael Sonnen for the first time.
Ooh,
and so he had just kicked Vitor Belfort's face off.
I'll stay Silva, but again, yeah, he would have looked just human against Sonnen.
I agree. This would have been the most that he had ever been pushed. That is, as Adesanya. So I'm with you. I'm gonna stick with Silva. All right, up next, this is one that's in the headlines now: George St. Pierre against Kamaru Usman.
2013 was when the Hendricks fight took place. So 2011 puts us at what? Not Condit. Yeah, it's around there. It's probably what? Jake Shields, John Fitch time, something like that, if I'm not mistaken. And Kamaru Usman looks like an absolute monster and machine right now. And so did GSP at that point.
So yeah, 2011 is right before Jake Shields.
Okay.
So, I think this was in promotion. So, yeah, he beat Dan Hardy March of the previous year, beat Josh Koscheck December of the previous year, and was about to fight Jake Shields.
This is going to hurt. I'd say probably Kamaru Usman. I'd say Kamaru Usman. It's tough because GSP at that point was starting to morph into that boring fighter, and Kamaru Usman's last fight was boring, so now everybody wants to lump him into that GSP category. But I think fight for fight and style for style, Usman could have beat prime GSP. It's close, and I might get a lot of hate for that, and I'm taking my Canadian hat off right here, but yeah, I'm going to say Usman.
I'm going to go with GSP only because I think that if you put Josh Koscheck and Jake Shields in the UFC now, I think they'd both give Kamaru Usman a good fight. So if those two could go five rounds with Kamaru Usman, I think that and GSP dominated both, then I think that GSP would also dominate Kamaru Usman. All right, let's move on to Frankie Edgar and Khabib Magomedov.
Not even close. Khabib destroys him.
I agree. We don't even need to look at the records. Let's get to Jose Aldo and Volkanovski. This is another fight that's also happened. So, obviously, the Jose Aldo of then is not the Jose Aldo of now. So who do you got, Jose Aldo versus Alexander Volkanovski?
I'm going two for two for Volkanovski in that one. I really do think that he beat him. I do.
All right, so let's talk about 2011 for Jose Aldo. So Aldo.
We're right around the Grisby times.
2011, Mark Hominick. So he had beat. You're right on the money because he had a bout with Grisby and got canceled. So he had beaten Uriah Faber in that big co-promoted WEC UFC weird thing. Then he beat Manny Gamburian. Then he beat Mark Hominick. I'm going to go with Jose Aldo. I think he just is faster than has more, brings a lot more to the table. So we move on. All right. And lastly, Dominic Cruz versus Petr Yan. Obviously this is Dominic Cruz, 2011.
Yeah, we talked about this fight last week, saying that maybe it's a possibility for 2020 if the stars aligned, but they won't. I think the Dominator would give him a good fight back then. I honestly do. I think, you know, so many wonky angles. The footwork was so much better. I think Cruz has a good shot in that one. I mean, he's not the GOAT for no reason at 135, right?
So leading into this fight, he just had a split decision win in August over Benavidez. He'd beaten Scott Jurgensen, and then he was about to beat Uriah Faber for the second time.
Still fine with it.
All right, Craig, let's move on. Let's get to start the conversation. We'll hit the other stuff later. So this week, Yana Kuniskaya tweeted in reference to USADA that her and Thiago Santos spent 2 months in Russia and then 6 in Brazil. USADA did not test them once. Her first week in the U.S., and she's already been tested. Makes me wonder if all the athletes training outside the United States being tested regularly. Is this a problem? And if so, what's the fix?
Well, it's a big problem, and I don't know what the fix is. Like, do you partner yourself with WADA, and then you have World Anti-Doping Agency agents testing in different countries? It seems pretty suspect. Like, there's a lot of blind spots, and I get it. With USADA, there's a blind spot. Whatever that company is that the UFC has doing meal prep, they made such a big deal about it. But if you're in the States, you can get it in certain spots. If you're in Vegas, you can definitely get it. But if you're in Canada, no dice. If you're worldwide, no dice. So overall, with USADA, I don't know what you do. I don't have a hard, concrete answer because you have to test everybody. You should.
You do, but I think it becomes a budget issue. I think that there's just too much to get done and too many fighters. And, you know, I know that the UFC plays a role in this in terms of funding it. But ultimately, I think that there has to be a process for doing it. But it takes too much resources to get all these fighters tested and expect that, you know, I mean, there's cycles, and if the UFC is going to have this big of a roster, either they need to independently fund USADA. And then what does that bring into the play? If now they're funding USADA, I mean, they're the ones that are benefiting from it. Maybe a percentage of the, maybe fighter pay fixes this. Maybe a percentage of the fighter's pay goes to his own USADA testing. That could be a way to go as well.
Let us know. We're starting the conversation.
There you go. Okay, guys, there you have it. This episode of Early Stoppage on Fight Night Picks is in the books. Be sure and comment under the video. Let us know what you'd like to see next from the show here on YouTube, but also on iTunes and Spotify. Craig can be followed at Craig Allen FFP. I can be followed at SM Cornerman. The fight has been stopped. We'll see you next week. Craig, say something witty.
Let's get into it.